Today, more from the property market frontline. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one of the latest posts covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. And today I'm joined by Chris Bates, the financial planner and mortgage broker. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Martin. Good to see you again.
Indeed, and thanks very much for spending some time with us. And boy, it's been an interesting few weeks, hasn't it? So maybe if we could just talk generally, talking about what you're seeing with regard to the property market and the bounce. Then I would like to talk specifically about the high-rise question, because I think that's one very much front of mind at the moment. And maybe we could end with perhaps answering a specific question that I received the other day, and perhaps we can explore that. But let's start generally. So is there a bounce in the property market or isn't there? What are you seeing?
Well, I don't know, Martin. We've had a number of chats now for maybe over 12 months. And, you know, a lot of my thoughts on the market for that last 12 months have been quite pessimistic and a bit worried about the election and what could happen with negative gearing, etc. And it does seem like there has been a real pent-up demand of buyers who have been thinking about buying but haven't been, in Sydney more generally, haven't been able to buy in 16, 17, maybe even 15, 14, where they didn't have the savings, they didn't have the income, but also the market ran away from them. So they got pushed out. And, you know, they waited 17, 18, and then early 19, the market had corrected and they didn't want to buy, even if they could buy, because they were just, well, why would you buy now? Let's wait for the, keep falling, wait for the bottom. But I feel like a lot of those buyers, that pent-up demand of people who have been thinking about buying for so many years, they're actually coming into the market. We are, you know, very busy. We've got lots of people who are very interested in kind of getting in and have that kind of confidence that they, you know, they kind of maybe had in the boom. It's kind of come back. They're not worried about price falls as much. So I think, you know, the reality is, though, now there's just very little stock across the whole market in the inner premium suburbs or the inner rings. And so it's hard to know whether, you know, there is competition. You know, I've been to quite a few auctions recently as well. And, you know, you have seen people competing and prices have been pushing up. So it's hard to know if this bounce is sustainable if more stock comes to the market over spring. But I don't know. It's hard to really know, you know, where things are going to go. My gut is, though, more stock's not going to come on until prices recover to where they were. And because people have got this kind of natural loss aversion and they think their property was worth what it was in 2016. So if the prices do rebound to where they were, my gut is you'll start to see a lot more stock hit the market then. And so that's going to create a plateauing effect. So, it's very hard to say. But, I mean, all the guns are out, right? You know, cutting interest rates, pushing up servicing, you know, all the things they could possibly do, you know, to protect the market they are.
So the question I have then, Chris, is the people who are now coming into the market, are these people who were, you know, first-time buyers, or are they people looking to trade up?
I'm getting more the first-time buyers.
Okay.
Yeah, I think in the, you know, the upgraders are still, you know, the because prices haven't recovered yet,
yep,
they need that extra cash to cover the deposit on the next one. And so while they're concerned about their next price of the property going up, they kind of sometimes need their property to rebound, to create equity so they can go and do that. So it's more the first home buyers that are kind of been saving and now they're like, oh, actually, maybe we shouldn't wait. We should just get in now. And there isn't this kind of big, hairy kind of moment like the election coming up that they're worried about, and I think they have been worried about it.
Okay, so we've got first-time buyers, and you said that they're looking perhaps closer in. That's because, of course, property prices have dropped down, so effectively they can perhaps buy closer in and perhaps buy a property of higher standard and higher quality than they could have previously. What's your sense in terms of how much the lending standards have eased for those particular first-time buyers relative to, say, 6 months ago?
The APRA changes haven't come through yet. Westpac sneakily did it and then got told off by APRA last week,
yep,
which was quite humorous. I mean, they sent texts out to brokers saying we can do it. And then it all of a sudden went viral and then APRA found out. So it was quite funny how it all went down. But, I mean, nothing really has changed. The living expenses issue I'm surprised it just hasn't popped up more. I feel like a lot of the banks are kind of taking customer declared living expenses. There, you know, a few banks are kind of pushing loans through and approvals aren't any problems. We haven't had a decline loan for ages because, you know, banks are just approving loans again. And but I don't know. I think it's I don't know what's going to happen with the living expenses thing. It's just, I don't know. It's just interesting to see what happens there. Nothing's really been solutions come up. It's like, what's going to happen with open banking? Are we going to go back to how it used to be? I don't know. You know what I mean? So it's very up in the air.
And of course, the revised HEM, you know, it came in about 3 weeks ago, has actually lifted that baseline expenses by about 15 to 20% on average, but particularly more at the top end in terms of the income range. So I guess that's also shaping some of the applications that are being put in at the moment.
Yeah, I think it is, but it's kind of, if that's where it ends up, that's nowhere near as where it could have been if they used actual living expenses. So to me, that would just be a slight tweak. And if that's the end result, and the big doomsday scenario where they use actual living expenses, which I think would have been, you know, definitely cut borrowing capacities dramatically, especially even after the assessment rate getting reduced. If that doesn't happen, then I actually think they've missed an opportunity. I actually think it's something to change that needs to happen. You need to, you know, live the way that you want to live long term before you apply to get your loan, not just assume people are going to change the way they live. So I think the banks have that data and they have that knowledge. They should have to go and verify it and make, you know, take. But I think open banking, how can a bank, you know, not turn their blind eye to it like they have in the past when open banking comes in?
Well, it will certainly, I think, change the game. Of course, the big four are dragging their feet a little bit on open banking at the moment. Surprise, surprise.
Exactly, yeah.
Why wouldn't they? I guess the other thought that I've got is, if it is first-time buyers who are effectively those who are reacting most strongly to the changed market conditions, by definition, there's a relatively small pool of first-time buyers who really can come into the market and want to get into the market. So this is not necessarily going to be sufficient to stoke the whole of the market up, is it?
No, I mean, you've got first home buyers, you've got upgraders, downsizers, you know, up like, you know, affordable, aspirational, you've got lots of different buyers. I'm kind of talking about a very small pocket, you know, that generally early 30s couples on, you know, two solid incomes in the city, and they're trying to buy in areas where there's very limited stock. And, you know, I guess that's one pocket, but is that going to spread and the ripple going to go all the way out to the suburbs? I definitely don't think so. And I really don't see any type of bounce back into the outer rings, especially the house and land packages and kind of newer townhouses and things like that. You know, and I think a lot of that was pushed up because developers were going out there as well with the idea of you can easily buy these, you know, $1 million block of land and sell three townhouses easily. That confidence for that mum and dad kind of developers not going to come back anytime soon. So I'm really kind of still pessimistic on those outer rings. I just can't see the confidence and the borrowing capacities and the problems with unemployment. And, you know, I just don't think that's going to bounce back.
Right. So it's really proving what you said previously, which is the market is actually multiple markets and we're going to see very different dynamics playing out in different locations. I mean, I've been watching, for example, places like Miranda and, you know, places like that and sort of south of Sydney, you know, prices are down there 14, 15, 16%. And what's happening now is that people who were looking down Wollongong way are now looking up there, because essentially they can begin to think they might be able to buy up there. So it is having a knock-on effect negatively to some of the outlying suburbs and some of the regional areas. And so, for example, in the area that I know very well around Wollongong, demand has really fallen away over the last few weeks, simply because now people can actually buy closer into the city. So, you know, for every up, there's a down.
100%, Martin. It's exactly it's the truth, really. I mean, what happens is the first-time buyers at that price point, they start, you know, it sounds a lot, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners get, you know, blown away with these numbers, but, you know, the low 1 millions is kind of where the comfort factor really just goes out the window for a lot of young couples. And in the boom, the inner west of Sydney is kind of where they were shopping, and then that kind of got pushed out, and they couldn't buy in the east and the north, and because it was just already too expensive, and then they went to the south of the Central Coast and the north of Wollongong, which is where you are.
Yep.
And that's where they went, and those areas boomed late at the end of the Sydney boom.
Yep.
But now that, you know, it's more affordable in the inner west, and there's some pockets in the north that they can afford again, they're going there. And my gut is, though, once they've gone up in price over the next period, places like yours will be the next kind of place that they think, because of all the lifestyle benefits of living on that real kind of north of Wollongong. And that's kind of what home buyers do. They kind of go where they can get best value for money with lifestyle. And so, yeah, it's not all interconnected like one price fall across the whole city.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, prices in the area that I've looked at around here, like Coromandel and places like that, they're down nearly 10% now. Units more than houses, actually, because there's less supply of houses relative to units. But that takes me to sort of my next conversation, right? So there's been a lot going on with regard to the high-rise sector of the marketplace. And one of the things, of course, we've got is the issue with regard to the most recent tower that's now shrinking, whatever the right word is, going down. So the one at Mascot, we had Opal Tower previously. We know we've got a question now, much more broadly spread across high-rise developments over the last decade at least. So how do you think this is playing into what's going on at the moment? And, you know, should people avoid high-rise at the moment? What's your perspective on that?
I've never, ever been a fan of kind of high-rise. To me, it just breaks all the rules around what makes a good investment. You know, when you've got kind of demand and supply, if you can't control supply and you can just keep building more of them, then why is it going to go up in value? And the only way you're going to do that is create more and more demand that outstrips supply. But that's kind of counterintuitive, because if prices go up, that means developers build more. You know, because they can sell them for more and they can make more profit. And so that's what happened in the boom. You know, the developers could sell 2-bedroom apartments for $1 million because they could get away with it. But, you know, now they can only sell them for 800, and so then they don't build because there's not enough profit in it. And so I think that high rise is just, you know, from a supply point of view, you know, they're just never going to, unless there's something truly scarce about it. But even then, I would probably buy the older building or the older apartment in that area. That's got that scarcity, not the brand new building. I think the build quality risk that's coming out now, it was not discussed, you know, the last few years, you know, non-disclosure agreements, you know, just why would you want to put it on record that your building's got all these defects? Even still, unless you had that experience yourself, you kind of underestimated how bad it could be. But it's all coming out now, and I think it's a really, you know, good conversation to be having, because the reality is we've just built, you know, poor quality stock to sell to investors, and investors aren't that bothered. They just wanted something cheap, and so they just built what investors wanted, something quick and fast. And they try to make as much money as they could in the boom, because the longer they took to build, you know, properties, the less money they were leaving on the table. I think the reality is high rises, another reason why they're flawed is that they're very linked to the investor market, and the investor market is like a switch. It switches on and off. And some of these high-rise buildings are 80-90% investors. And so as you can see, there's no investors in the market now because of confidence, borrowing capacity, you know, potentially no longer interest-only loans, longer term. You know, so those markets, unless they, home buyers don't really want them, you know, and anywhere near enough to soak up all the demand that investors are leaving. And so, yeah, you just kind of fail on two points. Nothing, not good from a supply point of view, not good from a demand point of view. But then if you think about, well, what are you actually buying? Well, you're buying land and a building, but the land that you own, you know, you have to divide it by, say, 200 apartments or 100 apartments. So you don't even really own it, but technically you've got 1/100th of the piece of land. And that's what goes up in value generally. The building is just like a car. I mean, it's all shiny when you first move in, but it does get old extremely fast, and it loses value fast. And so most of your money goes into that, and to pay for the developer's profit. So, you know, I think they're really flawed investments. They've always have been. The reality is, though, is that a lot of people in Sydney still think they're good investments, and because they've gone up in value. And, you know, whereas in Melbourne and Brisbane, they just didn't go up. Because there was just more supply to equal the demand. But in Sydney, there was just this real FOMO that kicked in, and it pushed up every asset and even poor assets like high-rises. So I can't see those markets turning around for a long time until really the housing, all the good housing goes off the market again and people are forced to kind of buy high-rises. But I don't think with the Opal Tower thing, I don't think they're going to buy the old high-rises that have been built. They're going to buy the new ones, which are you know, environmentally friendly, sustainable, much higher build quality, you know, much higher, you know, certification and et cetera, not the old ones. So I'm really worried for all the people who own those.
Yeah, and of course, if you look at some of the price falls so far, you know, I look at North Ryde, which I think is quite an interesting area, right? More than 31, 32% off its peak if you look at units there. A lot of, you know, units thrown up over a relatively short period of time, pretty cheap construction, and, you know, now people who have thought they would actually be making a killing are actually losing significant amounts. Plus the fact that the rental streams are also decreasing as well, because in fact, if you look, rentals are actually sliding, and that's partly because there's, you know, more available property to rent, and frankly, people's incomes are not rising, and therefore they can't afford to pay more. So to me, investment property in a high-rise context makes no sense at all, certainly in Sydney. I doubt in Melbourne, and I doubt either in Brisbane now. And of course, up in the top end with the earthquake up there, it'll be interesting to see how many of the properties there that have been built relatively recently are also going to now be suspect because of the earthquakes. So I was talking to somebody the other day who's an architect, and he's basically said this has been a problem that's 20 plus years in the making in terms of the way that we've actually designed buildings, the way that they've been built down to a price. They've been built down to absolute minimum standards because, of course, if you go higher on the standards, you actually have to spend more on it, and you were trying to build down to a price. You were trying to sell off the plan. You were trying essentially to build quickly. You were effectively just wanting to sort of turn it, get people in there and move on, and then basically hope for that you know, six-year or 10-year window to pass before effectively you can walk away scot-free. And by the way, quite often the building firms, in any case, disappeared earlier than that, and therefore there was no recourse. So, I mean, this is, I think, something which we're going to hear a lot more of ahead. And, you know, my sense is that the politicians really are just trying to sort of, you know, fix the particular building that's actually got the problem. But actually, the root cause issues, which is what we have to actually get to, will take a long time to play out. And I can't see how prices in this sector of the market are going to do anything but go down and down and down.
Oh, I agree. I've always been very pessimistic and worried about the high-rise unit market. You know, and I was actually in Canberra on the weekend of all places, and you know, I was astonished with how much high-rise is happening in that town and in the city. And you know, they've all got the nice marketing, they've all got the beautiful designs and things like that. But you know, and all of a sudden you've signed an off-the-plan contract, and settlement risk, I think, in somewhere like that is got to be around the corner. And you know, even now, I do very little in the off-the-plan space to help clients. It's only when, you know, good people come to me and they say, look, can you really help me? And, you know, I want to help. And, you know, it's one at the moment in Marrickville. It's a one-bedroom studio. We paid $670. You know, the valuation will come back tomorrow, but he's already had a $570 valuation at a bank. And we're going to another bank. And there's nothing we can really probably do here. We don't actually know how to solve it. And settlement risk is going to really take off, and it's going to become a really big problem in the next 12 months to 18 months, because that's when, you know, all the cranes, if you go around Sydney, Melbourne, there's still lots of cranes, there's still lots of buildings to come, and it's going to be D-Day for a lot of them.
And the other point to make is there, I think about 100 building firms across the country have fallen over in the last month. It's not massively reported, but there's a consistent stream now of, you know, small to medium sized building entities who just aren't able to survive in this environment. And whilst a few of the very large outfits can probably survive for a bit longer because they've got more capital in the bank and probably they can pull more levers, this is another reason why I think that, you know, we've got to be really careful in this sector of the market. So I think we're both saying to anybody contemplating buying into the high-rise sector, be really, really careful. And, of course, remember, you don't have the Chinese that were buying two, three, four years ago, right? That's pretty much dried up completely as well. So the demand is just not there. And therefore, who are you going to be competing with? You know, who's the greater fool that you're going to sell to later?
Yeah, right? Exactly right.
That's the really interesting question. And I can't see how that's going to play out.
Yeah, I mean, just to echo you on the builders going bankrupt, one of my good friends who I chat to every week, he does that. He basically gets them off the banks once they go bankrupt, and the bank's in receivership. And he's saying there's so much coming on, and it's... that's what he was always waiting for, and it's definitely happening. And I mean, you saw it last week. I think it was Moelis who bought 50 odd apartments in Kirrawee. But you know, that's not good news if you own apartments near there. If they're going, so that's what they value it at. If you know, and they can't sell them. If the developer could sell them, you know, on the market, they would have. But they've just taken a cut price and got rid of 50. Yep. And so we're going to start seeing a lot more of that. You know, and that's not good for prices for every other apartment in Kirrawee. I think it was in Kirrawee where they're around that area where these are selling for 500. You know, and so we have to watch out for that because fire sales really affect the off the plan market. You only need two or three of them, especially in your building, until your apartment could be, you know, worth hundreds of thousands of dollars less, especially if you've got one of the worst ones in the buildings. If you're on ground floor or floor one or two, and things are selling cheap on floor 17, how's the value going to value your apartment? Now, if you have to refinance or you want to get out of, you know, move another interest-only loans, you can't because the valuer has to use that valuation in your building. Whereas if you buy in a small block of units, and that's more of a better investment of, say, 6 or 8 units, brick, art deco, quiet street, premium suburb, bigger apartments that suit families, parking, you know, et cetera, then you haven't really got those risks as much. And you can't really replicate them because they're not building in those areas like they are in the high-rise heavens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or help.
Yeah, and it's worth saying, I think, that, you know, this concept of a forced sale value, right, is something which people need to get their head around, right? The forced sale value is not the same as the, you know, best of market price that might be quoted or, you know, the price that you'd aspire to get, right? A forced sale value is typically 15, 20, 25% down, right? And so when people get into negative equity and have to sell, they can't assume they're going to get that full price. It will be a lower price. And by the way, that's what I use when I do my calculations on negative equity across the country, and I map it every month. I use a for sale valuation rather than the aspirational market value, because yeah. The reality is that in this sort of market, you will not get top dollar.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of these, you know, let's say they were settling in 16, 17, 18, 19. Most of the investors that buy them, because that's generally, you can have a look on the ABS data. You know, how many people rent in that area? Well, 20%. Well, that means that, well, 80% rent. Well, that means 80% of the properties are investors, you know.
Yep.
Investors love interest-only loans, you know, and have those investors over-leveraged and taken on interest-only, and they can't refinance now. And so I think the interest-only cliff's going to come out again, especially in these areas, with lower borrowing capacities and not being able to refinance.
Indeed, and it's fitting, I think, you've got a high rise behind you. It's rather appropriate given our conversation. Okay, so let me...
Well, these ones are going up, Martin, because these are commercial and these are, right. You know, very, very, you know, doing very well at the moment.
Okay, yeah, well, there you go. Maybe it's the commercial, although we could, another day we might explore commercial because I think there's some issues there as well. But let me go on to this... this particular question. So, you know, DFA gets a whole lot of questions from some viewers, and yeah. I try to answer as many as I can, but some of them I think require a little bit more of a financial planning and broker insight. And so what I wanted to do was just to discuss a particular question that I got a couple of days ago. We're a family of four, my wife and myself and two sons. We have managed to save enough funds to buy a house in the order of $650,000 with savings. Recently, we were speaking to our financial advisor. His advice was not to buy a house outright with savings. The advice was to take out a mortgage to buy the house and to put the savings in an offset account to offset the mortgage. The reasoning of the financial planner was that you could then use the funds in future to purchase investment property once the house would have appreciated in value. Now, he said, I find this somewhat strange advice. I therefore wanted to ask you a question on mortgage offset accounts. The questions are as follows. First, what is a mortgage offset account? Second, is it possible to buy a house outright with savings and have a dormant loan sitting against that without paying a monthly mortgage payment? And three, what are the pitfalls of setting up an offset account in the situation I described? Where would you use the mortgage in a later date to buy an investment property? So there you are, Chris. Very interesting question. And you know, yeah. A very typical situation, I guess. So I guess let's go step from the top. What is a mortgage offset account? Can we start there and then broaden the conversation from there?
Yeah, let's start it there. I mean, because I think the advice is some it's half good, half bad. In terms of the advisor, and I think that's interesting. So an offset account is just a savings account, basically, that's linked to your home loan, that instead of you getting interest, it saves you interest on your home loan. So if you've got a mortgage of $1 million, let's call round numbers, and you've got $100,000 in your offset account, every day interest is calculated. So the bank says, well, you owe us $1 million, we owe you $100,000, we'll only charge you interest on that day of $900,000. And it is calculated daily, and it's a some offsets are only half offsets, but most offsets are full offsets. So if you put in another $100,000 the next day into your offset account, it saves you interest straight away. You only pay interest on $800,000. So they're amazing. They're one of the best things you could possibly have with a home loan, because it saves you interest, but it also gives you access to your money. So if you ever need that money, you can just take it out of your savings account and spend it or whatever you need to do. So you've got, and you still got that, but you're not paying any interest. So it's not costing you anything. So offset accounts are amazing.
Right. So just to be clear then, if I've got money sitting in an offset account, I'll need to whip some of it out. I can, because basically it's a credit balance, right? But yeah, any money you keep in the bank offsets the value on the net basis based on the calculation that would be made for the mortgage outstanding, which means you pay less on your mortgage.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. And so of course, and the interest rate on the mortgage is always higher than the return you get on the deposit. So by definition, you're actually winning.
That's exactly, that was going to be my second point. As soon as you have a mortgage or a home loan, and you shouldn't really have any savings accounts, because really the best savings account is an offset account, because any savings account, you're likely to get 2.5%, let's call it, that most likely you're probably going to be working. So you're going to have to pay tax on that. So you're really only getting 1.5%, but you could be offsetting your mortgage, which is probably, 3.5-4% after tax. So really, if you've got a mortgage and you've got savings account, something's not right here. You really need to have that money into an offset account. That's kind of best practice.
Okay, good. All right. So then the second part of the question was, okay, so if I'm in a situation where I'm going to buy a property, then it would be more sensible perhaps, rather than just using all the cash I've got to basically have no mortgage, but to have a mortgage and basically offset it. Is that sort of the right way to think about it?
Yeah, so I mean, the advice is actually pretty sound if the client hasn't got really much other assets. Mm-hmm. So if that client said, I've got enough to buy the house, plus I've got $2 million in the bank, well, you might say, well, yeah, just buy it outright. You've got enough buffer, you've got enough cash. But if that's all the client's money, basically, I agree with the advisor there, is borrow 80%. Don't borrow more than 80%. There's no point paying lender's mortgage insurance. Mm-hmm. But if you borrowed at 80%, and you put the exact same amount in the offset account, it wouldn't cost you anything from an interest point of view to actually have that facility and have that cash available if you wanted to use it for something like renovation, or if something happened to your health or something like that. You haven't just tied up all your money in one asset, because you might not be able to refinance that loan in the future. You just never know what your situation is in the future. You might not have a job, you might not be able to, bank servicing could change, etc. So having, if he was going to buy something at $600,000, and he had $650,000, is you'd probably get a loan at $480,000 and put $480,000 in the offset account. Now, just to be clear as well, a mortgage broker who sets that up wouldn't get paid a single cent to do that, because the way that the new commissions are structured, it's much fairer now, is that the mortgage commission is based on the net offset account amount. So if you borrowed $480,000 and you put $480,000 in the offset account, there's no loan, so the mortgage broker isn't paid. So you might think that they're just trying to put you in debt, but personally I think it's good advice to borrow at 80% and put the rest into the offset account. But it's not for the reason, it's for a buffer reason. It's just from a protection point of view and to have access to cash if you need it from liquidity. It's not so you can go and buy an investment property. Now, if you to buy an investment property, what you would probably do is pay down that loan from $480,000 and pay it to $300,000, and then use the equity in that home to go and buy the investment property. So he could have just used, or if he didn't take out that loan originally, he could have just taken that security to the bank and used that as security for an investment property. So I don't really get the whole doing it for an investment property. I get it for doing it for liquidity reasons and buffers, and just not knowing when you might not be able to get access to that money in the future. The reality is when you need money the most is when banks won't lend it to you the most. And so you're better off having facilities open if it's not costing you anything. And I guess it's also a bit worrying if you're not very good with your money, because if you've got $480,000 looking at you in internet banking, it's tempting to go out and spend that money. So if you have got problems with controlling cash, then yeah, you might just want to have the title because then you might not spend it. So there are reasons why you might not have an offset account as well.
Yeah, okay, yes, and you're right, because you have to be disciplined about it, right? Because it's just sitting there, and for some people it's sitting there and it's got a please spend me sticker yeah. on it, right? That is always a problem, because effectively remember why you're holding it, right?
Yeah.
And I guess the other point to think about is, you know, that there's this sort of worry about deposit bail-in, right, which is one of those things that is very unclear in Australia. And there's been a lot of people who've asked me the question, well, hang on, if I've got an offset account and I've got a deposit account over here and I've got a mortgage over there, what's the likelihood of suddenly finding that that deposit account is bailed in and my deposits are now equity in the bank, right? And you know, the truth of the matter is nobody knows, because essentially it's not clear as to precisely how a bail-in process would work. I would have thought the right of offset would probably come into play first, but there's no formal statement that I've seen to suggest how it might play out in practice.
Yeah, it's interesting, because it wouldn't take much for the banks to do a bit of a wreck across the whole loan book and kind of do a margin call on property. I was really worried about that, actually, because, you know, in the decline, you know, especially people with redraw, that was more likely, I think, to happen, where you had a redraw facility in the bank. And I think CBA started to play around with this a little bit, where, you know, they could say that to get access to that redraw, it's not your money anymore, it's the bank's money. And to get more than $10,000 redraw, you have to go through a credit assessment or something like that. And so people assume that their redraw is their money and they can always pull it out. But I don't think that's safe enough, personally. I'd much rather have that money in an offset account. But if they then were going through that process, I mean, I guess you could be pretty quick in seeing that happening and move that money from the offset account to another bank or something like that. I think foreclosing on kind of people's properties and making them pay off debt would be a real kind of, you know, doomsday. But I kind of feel like it could happen to big time investors and big risks rather than kind of homeowners. Mm. You know, it's not going to look good on Channel 7 or Today Tonight or something for homeowners for the banks. But for big investors, you know, there was talk of a letter last year that went around from Westpac that, you know, people who had more than 7 properties, or maybe it was more than $5 million, Westpac was asking them to basically go to other banks. Okay, sent them a letter and said, you know, look, we no longer want you as a customer. Now, that's pretty scary. I haven't heard of that happen. Now, I never saw a copy of that letter, but there was a lot of talk about it in the press and within the broker community.
Mm. Yeah, well, I actually got a copy of that letter.
Did you? A
letter, yes. And it was from a particular bank. I won't say whether it was Westpac or not. That individual asked me not to share it, so I haven't shared it with anybody. But basically, the argument was, we've done a review of your relationship with us. You no longer fit within our preferred criteria. We're giving you notice that we'd like you to you know, take some of your business elsewhere. We will help you through that process. But basically, it was they wanted to reduce the risks. So it definitely is out there.
Yeah, I had it from another... from a client who was trying to come to me to refinance, and you know, unfortunately he hadn't been taking care of his, you know, repayments very well, and, you know, just basically was running a bit tight, and what didn't look good, and we didn't know till we started looking, and the bank had actually told him to leave and was closing on him, and you know, in reality he hadn't actually missed any repayments, they just didn't like the way he was kind of managing his account.
Yeah. And I think this is what we're going to see more of, right? I've got the view that we're going to see the banks being a bit more picky. You know, if you are a low risk, somebody with a very strong track record of savings and a low loan to value ratio, you'll get remarkably good loans out there. That, you know, the rates that are on offer now are as low as they have ever been, right?
Yeah, 100%.
But if you are not in that sort of category, if you are in the, you know, the lesser credit category, or, you know, there are other adverse situations or adverse risks, I'm seeing those really finding it very difficult to do anything other than get locked into the loans they've already got. They certainly can't get those new cheaper loans. And on every occasion where there's an opportunity to kick them out to somebody else, the bank will do it.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, it's all come down to the soft facts, not so much the hard facts anymore. And, you know, the behavior of, you know, the person applying for the loan, which is like character. And, you know, that's, you know, the things that you'd usually used to assess on loans. But, you know, in the boom, it was risk on, you know, well, if we don't do the loan, Westpac will, or if West, you know, and so we need to grow our market share. So I think things have shifted dramatically. And anything that's, you know, we're going, you know, full credit checks every application. We're going through and we're looking at credit card statements. We're closing down any facilities. You know, we hate seeing Afterpay. We hate seeing Zip Money, you know, all those sort of things. And we're really trying to present the customer in the best light. And if there's anything even around kind of changes of employment or, you know, changing employment 3 times in 2 years, we're putting a bit of a note in just to make sure that, you know, the things that assessor might think about could be a risk, even though before they would just approve it, we're just trying to put them, you know, get them in the best light, which we never had to do, to be honest. It was just always going to get approved.
Very interesting. So just then standing back, Chris, as we come to the end of our conversation, it sounds to me as though there are some, you know, green shoots in places across the market, but not uniformly so. And there isn't certainly enough evidence to suggest that we're going to see a massive rebound of prices. You know, this is going to be a long, long, slow grind. And there might be, you know, some green shoots, but don't take that for the summer, right? Because it's probably not going to be that that style of recovery.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of the ripple effect, which we kind of talked about before. But once those inner ring suburbs kind of go up, then people move to the next suburb and the next suburb. And it takes many years for it to push out to the outer suburbs. And I think going, you know, in reverse, I think the out suburbs could be going down and the inner ring suburbs could be going up in the next, you know, 12 to 18 months. You could see the inner ring suburbs, shortage of supply, demand pushing those suburbs up, not at all price points, and, you know, and not in apartments and not in units. And so I don't think, but my worry, you know, not worry, but my thoughts are that even if prices do rebound, as soon as we get back to where they were in, you know, 2016, more stock will hit the market. And you'll just start seeing a sideways movement. And we'll just, and all the realities of no wage growth and, you know, tighter lending, you know, people will start capping out again. And we'll start to see this real kind of sideways movement. We're not going to get anything like we did in 13 to 16.
Indeed. Well, I think it'll be interesting to watch because, of course, these things are quite unpredictable, and we'll probably have more interest rate cuts and quantitative easing, and, you know, international crises could bubble. You know, who knows? But you know, we'll keep tracking this with you, Chris, over the next few months and weeks, and perhaps as we get more questions in from our viewers, we might you know, pick your brain again, because I think it's really good to kick around, you know, real life questions. So maybe we'll say, you know, if people have specific questions that you'd like us to explore, you know, let us know and we'll see whether we can help.
Yeah, perfect. That would be amazing.
Chris, I really appreciate your time today. That's been very interesting.
Cheers, Martin. Good to see you again.
See you again. Bye. Cheers. Bye.